Welcome to Bringing Forth, a podcast on spirituality and parenting, where we share stories, insights, and wisdom at the intersection of parenting, spirituality, and real life. This is your host, Rachel Dahl O'Mahony. This week, I was snuggling with one of my children, and they said to me, "When I grow up, I want to be an artist like you." I felt as though I was tumbling over myself. Like me? Like me? I'm not an artist. I've always wanted to be one, to create things, to make things, to imagine the world with new boundaries. But before I jumped right onto my inadequacy train, I took a moment and tried to imagine and welcome my child's vision of myself. Maybe I am an artist. Just maybe. So, if you see this podcast as an art, will you support the arts by being a patron? Please join this week's newest patrons. Shout out to Mary, Gail, Hillary, and Mark. Join them and other supporters in supporting me at patreon.com/bringingforthpodcast. And also follow me on social media and Instagram or Facebook. So we're 6 episodes in, and I feel like I owe you listeners an explanation. My hope is to develop conversations with all kinds of parents and all kinds of families. For those of you who have yet to feel represented in this podcast, but have listened anyway, I'm sorry. And also, deep thanks. Right now, things are looking pretty white, pretty two-parent householdy, pretty Christian, and pretty upper middle class. There's no way that's representative of what family and parenting looks like across the board, even if the board here is the United States. I'm trying, as I set up interviews and read books and research and foster real relationships, to explore places that decenter Christianity, whiteness, and the myth of the nuclear family. I am trying, and I'm fumbling a bit, and I'm bumbling, and I'm constantly bumping into opportunities for vulnerability. If you need to call me out or invite me in, and I'll listen, and I'm working on it. Today's guest did missionary work of various kinds in Africa. Most of what he did included setting up theological education centers. Maybe because of my background, and because I'm a millennial, because of my communities, I'm deeply concerned about perpetuating colonialism in Africa. And I'm critical of a Western martyr, do-gooder sensibility. My religious sense makes me allergic to certain kinds of missionary work. But Jim, today, invited me to consider a middle space. Now, don't get me wrong. We talked about a lot of different things that I thought were helpful and thoughtful and interesting. But it was his thoughts on colonialism and Africa and capitalism that really invited me to further reflection and I think a place of honesty and conversion in that honesty. Yes, colonialism was terrible in many, many ways. There's no denying that. It is terrible in many, many ways, and capitalism has stolen many, many things from many people and cultures. And as a white American, I can't just run from those injustices and cruelties. I cannot just say that was evil, now it's over and done. I have benefited from those injustices and cruelties, and I still do. Since this interview, I have felt myself taking a humbling breath. I don't know what the solution is. I don't pretend to know. But putting my head in the sand and just declaring loudly, "That was bad," isn't the answer. It's just performative white liberalism, which I'm comfortable with, but isn't the solution. In my interview with Jim, I left feeling invited to be more curious, to be reflective, to be a quiet listener to voices I might have never included in the conversation, to be vulnerable and to consider my place in the solutions. A native of the Philadelphia area, Jim Pfeiffer is a graduate of Biblical and Westminster Theological Seminaries there. He's been a pastor and done missionary work in Africa, living in Namibia and Zimbabwe for 11 years. Jim has done chaplaincy work in various settings, including behavioral health and acute care hospitals. He is a certified educator working with CPE students at Johns Hopkins Bayview Medical Center in Baltimore and St. Vincent Hospital in Indianapolis. Jim is an ordained minister in the Presbyterian Church, USA. He and his wife, Robin, have 4 children and 18 grandchildren. Jim is straight, white, cisgendered, and middle class. Welcome, Jim. I'm glad to have you. Okay, so we'll just open up with the parenting question. So who are you parenting? How did your children come to you through biological adoption, things like that? Who are you parenting with? And then for you, Jim, who are you grandparenting and parenting in law?
So my wife is Robin, and she and I have been together for 46 years in terms of our married life together. We have 4 biological children, 2 boys and 2 girls. All of those children are married and have children of their own. We have 18 grandchildren from our four children's marriages, 2 of whom are adopted children, international adopted children. So the range of those grandkids is from sophomore in college, the oldest, to I think first grade, 5 or 6 years old. Parenting in law. I have 2 sons in law and 2 daughters in law. And all of these children of mine are in their 40s or at least 40 years old. And except my youngest child, who is 39, will be 39 this year. Our children they're committed to their spouses in terms of the context in which we're talking today, Rachel. They're committed to their children. They're good at being parents, I think.
Share about your religious and spiritual background.
So I grew up in a Baptist church. It was strongly ethnic, German. On my dad's side, we were very heavily involved as a family. My parents had an evangelical religious experience as young adults, and so they raised us in that milieu. I went through a period of adolescent and young adult, I'm going to call it self-discovery, in which the formal church really receded in my thinking and in my practice. Early in my 20s, I experienced a real longing for spiritual connection. I had been sort of living very much as a party guy, but I felt a real gap in my life in terms of my spiritual connection. So I turned to the spiritual community that raised me. I didn't know any other spiritual communities. And so then that led to theological training in that tradition, that evangelical tradition. I sensed a call to ministry. So I continued my training, and eventually that led to ministry in that world. Over the years, I felt kind of a growing dissatisfaction with certain aspects of my tradition and a growing awareness that really deep spirituality was being experienced by people outside of the church walls altogether. This seems obvious, maybe, Rachel, for a lot of people. Oh my gosh, there's spirituality outside of my group. But it really wasn't for me. It wasn't that obvious. And it was a revelation for me to realize that the quest for the holy is part of the common human experience opened up for me a much wider set of spiritual influences and really freed me from a narrowly defined spirituality. So, as I say, I self-identify as a Christian, but practically, in day-to-day terms, I feel like I'm on a journey of discovery.
Could you share an experience where you felt this sense of, or had a sense or an instinct that God is bigger than this doctrine or this one way of being?
maybe not a single story, but a series of repeated awarenesses. So I have always had a deep sensitivity with music and literature and arts, even though I'm not an artist, but those areas of the human experience have always kind of been a doorway for me to a very tender part of my experience. And so I have had repeated experience of listening to music or reading a novel, reading a piece of poetry, and just floodgates of emotion opened up within me. And I thought, gosh, what's this about, you know? And those instances felt deeply spiritual to me. In fact, they were times in which I knew of the other and the holy in ways in which my church experience hadn't provided. So those were the kind of instances that really made me realize that spirituality for me could include the church, but it had to also extend beyond its walls.
You said that those experiences were deeply emotional. What was the nature of those emotions? Was it sadness or joy or...
I would say I would describe the emotion as awe. Sometimes there was sadness, but it was more a sense of awe at the wonder of living in this universe. The wonder of, perhaps rather than wonder, let me switch to a different word, the beauty of that piece of music or that piece of art that I was reading. So it was just this sense of just the way things fitted together, the meshing of things, the meshing of the human experience with the universe came to me in those moments, and kind of the rightness of it all. And those have been really some of my peak religious moments. You know, those kinds of things have brought me to, you know, kind of to the edge of the chasm.
So you've been parenting for over 40 years, parenting in lots of different life stages and then grandparenting. Can you talk about your spiritual life in relationship to parenting? How perhaps images of God have expanded or collapsed? How, yeah, your spiritual worldview has been impacted as a parent?
Yeah, so parenting is a big challenge. I don't pretend to have been a great parent over 40 years, but it's been really the joy of my life at the same time to parent. Images of God in relation to parenting. I have grown up with the concept of God as Father. The idea of God as Father and me as Father have sort of clashed enough that my understanding of God as Father has grown or evolved. I had this kind of God with knitted brow concept that was really strong for me as a kid growing up. You know, kind of God as annoyed or just waiting, you know, for some mistake to happen. And I believe that I probably have, at times in my life, parented that way. I have not been I'm not a violent or an angry person. But I think I have conveyed annoyance at times to my children in ways that I know and even knew then was inappropriate and that I regretted. So I've been really trying to realize that is a caricature of God that has been foisted upon me, you know, by people who maybe wanted God to toe the line that they towed. It's hard for me to dislodge that concept, but I think God's voice is more melodic now. I may call him Father, but he has traits that are very motherly, very, very tender. And so some of my ideas of fatherhood and maleness have gone by the wayside.
I appreciate you talking about that. I don't pretend to be a great parent. I'm in this class right now. We're talking about psycho-spiritual formation in children, which actually just makes me feel like a terrible parent rather than making me reflect on my own childhood. So I'm suddenly already keenly aware of some of my mistakes and becoming more aware of these are going to be some of my kids' issues when they grow up. So as somebody who has adult children, how do you manage reflecting back and realizing, oh, I wish I would have done that differently? Or,
well, I've had to apologize as a parent for some of the mistakes that I realized I made, and I'm sure there are many other mistakes that should be apologized for that I'm just not aware that I made. Our children have been very gracious to us. We've kidded about some things that, some parenting mistakes that we've made. They have kidded with us about those. Times where we were angry with them, you know, in ways that probably reflected more of our own fear at the time of, they've shared, you know, sometimes that we went ballistic. They do so laughingly, and we laugh with them about it. My biggest challenge, I will say, as a parent of adult children, has been in oversharing my opinions, mm-hmm. not allowing my children to be the adults that they already were. They don't need to know my opinion. It has given me a lot more joy, actually, to be able to sit back and watch them. I mean, I think about my mom and dad and my wife's mother and dad. You know, we packed up four kids and hopped on a plane to Africa with no plan to come back for the next, you know, 5 years, mm-hmm. 4 years. Amazingly, my parents just didn't share with us their apprehension about this huge step that we were taking with their grandkids. Mm-hmm. And so that's always been a model for me. Gosh, you know, if they could keep their mouth shut, surely I can.
In reflecting that question next to the question about images of God and Father, and then this, the furrowed brow God sounds like the God of a parent of a toddler. You know, like, get out of the plant, stop messing with the dirt, or stop doing that, where there's a different image of Father in the, like, hands off, if you want advice, you can come to me, that I find really liberating, to think of God's parenthood looking like, I trust you, but I'm here if you want, that I'm pretty into how that is forming there.
I really like what you were just saying about how it shows us different images of God. I mean, God, he's not exactly butting in to my life all the time. God is not always, you know, shouting at me from wherever God sits. And so why would I want to be that sort of interfering parent? God is sort of absent, as it were, in terms of my experience of God day in and day out. And yet there's a presence in God for me that I'm here if you need me, that I take advantage of. I interact with God on a regular basis, but it's often my initiative and God's willingness to be present when I need God to be present.
So would you talk about your experience in Africa a little bit? How did you discern that? What were you thinking? And now that you are out of that, how do you think it impacted them and their religious imagination and you and your religious imagination?
Part of the discernment of that grew out of the tradition in which we found ourselves, a tradition which valued, what does mission work mean? Mm-hmm. Mission work in that tradition was taking the gospel to other cultures. I've never been a person who has been comfortable with evangelism as it's often practiced, you know, confrontational kinds of evangelism. But in the larger context of working with the church internationally, I saw a place for me in theological education. And so that's what we went to Africa to do, to educate potential church leaders, okay, to provide theological education. So we started a theological school in the capital. We lived in Namibia. And so it was in a place of acting not so much evangelistically, but in a way of teaching people theology and both practical and systematic and biblical studies, those kinds of topics in our work there. So how did that impact us? How did that impact our kids? Oh, yeah. How old were our kids? Three of them were in school when we went. I think the fourth one started school after we got there. Well, we were there with them in that context for 7 years. So when we came back, our oldest son was a junior in high school. Then we had a 10th grader, an 8th grader, and a 6th grader. How did it impact us all spiritually? I think to the good. I mean, it opened up our world immensely, both religiously and in terms of what it means to be a human on the planet. Living across culturally was an immense privilege that we could not have inculcated our children in without the actual experience of living there. It has helped me and all six of us really to understand that the world is bigger than our small experience of it, that other people see things differently and their position, their perspective is a legitimate perspective. I think it has helped us all see what it means not only to be white, but to be an American through a different lens. It's a lens that understands that poverty is the experience of most of the people on the planet, that helps me be a better steward, I believe, of the many economic benefits that I have. I think it's a lens that has put into my heart and into my lifestyle kind of a perpetual concern for people whose only mistake, and I say it in quotes, was their place of birth in the economic sense. And I don't mean mistake that anybody made one, but I mean it. So it's really changed my thinking about myself.
So I think there's a new energy in this generation that's really critical of capitalism and colonialism. It sounds like your experience in Africa set you up for that in a lot of ways. Does that seem true? And I can't help but think about the ways that Christianity is in pretty direct conflict with a lot of parts of capitalism and colonialism. Could you say more about that?
There's no question the sad history of how missionaries were co-opted by colonial governments who used religion as a means of exercising control over countries and people, bringing compliance on the part of those colonized people to the dominant government's way of thinking. And there's no denying further than that even apart from that sort of geopolitical perspective, many individual expats, whether missionaries, military, members of the diplomatic corps, employees of multinational corporations, as individuals take advantage of the economic power differential in the third world and practice racism. So there's no question that it's a macro problem and a micro problem, and will continue to be that as long as powerful countries interact with weak and poor countries. Having said that, I think there are also ways in which good-hearted people have worked cross-culturally for good and still do. I mean, I believe that I have a responsibility, that we have a responsibility as Westerners, wealthy Westerners, to help people who are poor, frankly. And a lot of good work is being done. That requires some sort of interface between rich and poor. And I believe good-hearted people are working in that interface successfully, selflessly, generously, and effectively. At the same time, I want our listeners to hear me say that I recognize that some people are not doing it that way. they're taking advantage of, even in small ways. You talk about microaggressions here, and with no ill effects accruing to them for their aggressive colonial racist behavior. The economic advantage that they have is hard for some of them to not use for their benefit.
How did that, you know, God differently from that experience?
I grew up in a tradition where God's preferential treatment or preferential disposition toward the poor was not part of what we heard all the time. And so when I came upon that dimension of Scripture and that those kinds of experiences made it real for us. Let me tell you another story. Part of our role in this last five-year stint that we had was to visit four countries in Southern Africa in terms of our ministry. And I remember driving into this one church meeting that was in a village, and so many, many people had gathered in this village for a series of meetings, all to be held outside. These were people, this was Mozambique, these were people who were very poor. Mozambique had just come out of a lengthy war. And they gathered around us with such singing and foot stomping and dancing and chanting that I was just kind of borne off my feet almost, you know, metaphorically speaking, and just lifted up. And they formed a long queue and pressed things into us, into our hands, gifts. I remember distinctly the Mozambican currency is called Metacash, and they would press into our hands these grimy, sweaty bills. And here were people who needed every bit of that money for their own lives. And here they are giving it to us. And we just pulled up in Land Rovers, for crying out loud. You know, here we are in our nice clothes, and they're literally in rags, and giving us chickens, giving us money, giving us gourds and ears of corn and all of this. And, you know, you just feel ridiculous to receive from them. And yet at the same time, How do I frame that for them? Because this was a church meeting, right? So nobody was compelling them to do this. This was their understanding of what it means to be a person of faith and a follower of God, that one gives. One gives to others, and that's a reflection of what God has done for us and what God wishes we would do more for each other. So that experience, I hadn't thought about it until you asked for a story. That experience for me was humbling and almost embarrassing, shame-inducing. And really it sets the tone for me in terms of what kind of giving is sacrificial and realistic and appropriate for me.
You know, Jim, you're a white American man, a thoughtful one. I suspect as a CPE supervisor, you're pretty intentional about your inner work and probably attentiveness to power dynamics and stuff. So how do you hold and manage your privilege? How is that management of your privilege and holding it part of your spiritual practice or your theological beliefs?
I have an exercise that I do with my students in a lot of our groups where we talk about earned and unearned advantage, and we talk about privilege. White privilege is a topic that we talk about, we read about. Sometimes with the term white privilege, we have to get past people's, obviously white people's defensiveness around that. But my prayer in it is sort of regular realization and reminding myself that God doesn't look anything like me. Jesus didn't look anything like me. And what a joke that I imagined, that I ever imagined God to be sort of this white guy. I mean, the foolishness of it. I guess when one thinks about it more and experiences the divine in the faces and the lives and the interactions of people that visibly and linguistically and in another way, economically, are unlike one, then that helps to make that real. In terms of my spiritual practice, understanding the diversity of the world, the different experience of many other people in the world, the obligation that I have for those who don't have economic advantages like mine, that for me just rises to the surface in terms of how I'm living out my Christian life.
I want you to talk a little bit about grandparenting. There's a like the myth of how awesome grandparenting is, or maybe it's a fact. I don't know. And what is it like to be a grandparent? Is it, yeah, what's it like?
It's really cool. We really like this stage of our grandparenting because our grandkids are now old enough that we can interact with them, you know, on a conversational level, conceptual level. And we have one of our grandkids who stays overnight with us one night a week because it fits in with a particular educational aspect for her. And it's just so nice to sit and talk and interact as an adult and to hear about her adult life. So I'm really loving that. I'm really loving talking to my grandsons about, you know, about the sports that they're involved in, the courses they're taking, and the people that getting introduced to girlfriends and boyfriends. And just it's just so fun because I really want to be for them a supporter, right? So a person who really has their back and who cares like heck about them and yet is not going to judge them. You know, when I think about who I remember as an adult, who I remember fondly, and it's the people who were interested in me, who cared about me, who weren't critical of me. I remember those people too, but not fondly. And I don't want to be in that group. I don't want to be the nagging grandfather or the bitchy grandparent. I really try to lend myself body, soul, and spirit to listening to them, to be present for them, and to be engaged with them in our interactions. We just had a day with one of my kids has 8 kids, and so we were with them. It was just delightful just to be around that noisy table and hear about their lives. It's just fills me with energy.
So tell me about why you and Robin decided to stop having children. It wasn't for, you didn't age out of it, I don't think. So how was that discernment?
Wow, you're taking us back a few years. We had all of our kids in our 20s. By the time my spouse was, let's see how old, 27. She had 4 children. And we just, at the time, I was in seminary and we were, you know, poor as we had ever experienced poverty. And we just felt like we couldn't continue to have children. We discerned it through just realizing that we would be getting pregnant again and again and again if we didn't make a definite decision about, you know, limiting our family. So it was a thoughtful decision, and we took some steps to that end. And I think we went through a little period, probably a few years later, of, she and I were actually just talking about this. It's been through a little period a few years later of thinking, wow, you know, wow, we're not going to have any more kids. We talked about adopting, but never got serious about it. And so, it was a decision that was intentional. We didn't intend to have the four children we had, the biological children we had. The limiting of our family was something we felt we had to do.
So what kind of insights do you have at the intersection of parenting and spirituality?
For me, parenting involves the whole gamut the whole roller coaster, the whole range of emotional experiences, and so does my spirituality. It has to. Both of those things, for me at least, are, you know, as real life as it gets. And so if one was divorced from the other, if one was so completely other that there was no interface, something would have to change for me.
So I get how those are that those are connected, right? That like parenting is sort of life lived very intensely. A healthy, robust spirituality in the midst of parenting can hold all of that. Yeah. In terms of practicalities, though, like what does that look like? You know, parenting is also full of daily chores of the feeding and caretaking of people's bodies and the laundry and all of that. I think it's easy to maybe feel some of those feelings and not know how to land them. In a life lived in real time, what's the actual container, at least for you, or containers you see maybe your kids using to hold the spirituality in real life together?
I think there is deep spirituality in the ordinary, in the everyday. I, for many years, have gone back to that part of scripture where the Apostle Paul says, whether you eat or drink, do all to the glory of God. Now, there was a time in my life where I thought that meant I had to think spiritual thoughts at all times. Spiritual meaning, oh God, you're wonderful, and I feel close to you, God, right now. You know, those kinds of consciously divine, I don't feel that anymore. I think that the act itself, that ordinary act itself, is a spiritual act. The laundry is spiritual. I do wash a lot of dishes. I like to cook. So I'm in the kitchen a lot with my spouse, and, you know, we're in the kitchen apart. But for me, that's all spiritual stuff, whatever I'm thinking about. I'm thinking about the hummingbird, you know, feeder right outside of our window where I wash my dishes. And, you know, I'm not thinking about God in that moment, but it has nothing to do with that religious thought. It's just this is part of what it means to be a human, to wash these dishes. This is what part of what it means to be a human, to you know, change that kid's diaper. So, you know, I guess I've become a little more, you know, Zen-like over the years to say, you know, this right now, this onerous task or this joyous task or this humdrum task is as meaningful as this beatific moment where I hear God in the strains of Mozart or in the lines of a Mary Oliver poem, right? So one is not better than the other. One feels better than the other. That doesn't mean that one is more valuable than the other.
Yeah, I think there's this narrative in spirituality that it should feel sort of blissed out, and that isn't my sense at all, that it's lived in complexity. I think about, there's a Mary Carr poem called The Voice of God. It's my favorite poem, but one of the lines in it is that God shows up in the small, the fond, and the local. And I have often thought of my three children as small, fond, and local, or as a reminder to, these are my voices of God. And I rarely feel blissed out around them.
For a number of years, you know, I was a preacher, right? So I was a pastor of a local congregation. And so part of that role is sermons. And, you know, much of the sermonic material in Scripture is about, you know, these heroes and these, you know, great moments. But it never ceased to amaze me how those were just, you know, kind of the flashes along the otherwise very long gray line of life. You know, this, you know, God shows up in this, you know, big storm or big event, but meanwhile, you know, somebody's out baking the bread, you know, 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, years later, you know, making the bread, you know, bringing the child into the world, you know, nursing that child, taking care of that skinned knee or worse. And, you know, that's all part of it too. Scripture, by giving us these high points, is not excluding the ordinary.
Thank you. Yeah. And then my final question is, what kind of advice do you have? Books, thoughts, perhaps inspirational poems for you? But yeah, any kind of advice?
Well, I think my advice to parents and people who are trying to be with, you know, someone else in the raising of a child, it comes down to really learning to love each other. I know that sounds trite and everyday and ordinary, speaking of ordinary, but that's really what it comes down to for me. And loving the other means not having my own way all the time. So love, compromise, thinking of the other before myself. These are the things I think that make for happy families.
Jim, thanks for doing this.
My pleasure. Loved it.